The title of this talk is Verdi and Schiller. The natural assumption would be that I shall talk about the fact that Verdi had a special affinity to Schiller, because he composed no fewer than four operas on subjects borrowed from Schiller's tragedies. But this is not the topic on which I intend to talk. I should like to talk about something quite different, namely about a certain distinction which Schiller, who was not only a great dramatist, but a critic of great depth and penetration, once drew, and which appears to me to be relevant to the musical work of Verdi. In 1796, Friedrich Schiller wrote an essay which he called Über naive und sentimentalische Dichtung, about naive and sentimental poetry. In this essay, which is a classic in Germany but is seldom read abroad, outside Germany I mean, Schiller distinguished two types of poets. The poets who are not conscious of any rift between themselves and their milieu, or any rift within themselves, and, on the other hand, writers in general and poets in particular who are conscious of this. For the first set of poets, art is a natural form of expression. They see what they see directly, and they seek to articulate it for its own sake, not for any ulterior purpose whatever, however sublime it might be. Let me quote Schiller's own words. Such poets occur in the youth of the world and later. They are severe and chaste, like the virgin goddess Diana in her woods. The dry, truthful way in which such a poet treats his material often resembles lack of feeling. The object possesses him entirely. His heart doesn't, like a cheap metal, lie on the very surface, but, like gold, must be sought in the depths. He is concealed by his works, like God, by the world he has created. He is his work, for the work is himself. Only someone who is unworthy of a work, only someone who doesn't understand it, or is in some way satiated by it, will look in it only for the creator. Who did he mean? What kind of poets was he thinking of? The examples he gives are Homer, Aeschylus, Shakespeare, even his own contemporary and friend Goethe belong to this first class of poets. They aren't, as poets, self-conscious. They don't, like Virgil or Ariosto, whom he also cites as the opposite, they don't stand aside to contemplate their creations and express their own feelings. These poets are at peace with themselves. Their aim is limited, and they are able, if they have genius, to embody their vision fully. These poets, Schiller calls naive. It's a technical use of the term. It doesn't, of course, mean naive as we use the word now. With these so-called naive poets, he contrasts the poets who came after the fall. Let me quote from Schiller again. When man enters the stage of culture, when art has laid its hand upon him, the primordial sensuous unity is gone, and the harmony between sense and thought, which in the earlier state was real, now exists only as an ideal. It is not in a man as a fact of his life, but outside him as an ideal to be realized. In other words, what Schiller is saying is that the primordial unity has been broken. Something has happened in the circumstances of the poet, in the world in which he lives, in his own internal emotional life, or his relation to other human beings, or to his environment, which in some sense has created a breach. The poet seeks to restore the original unity. He looks for the vanished harmonious world, which some people call nature, and builds it from his imagination. And his poetry is simply his attempt to return to it, to a kind of imagined childhood. And he conveys his sense of the chasm which divides the day-to-day world, which is no longer his home, from the lost paradise, which he now conceives only ideally, only in reflection. Hence, this ideal realm is bounded by nothing at all. It is in its very essence, according to Schiller, indefinable, unattainable, not capable of being embraced by means of any finite medium, no matter how great the poet's capacity for finding and moulding and transforming his material. Let me again quote from this remarkable essay by Schiller. Visual art reaches its goal in the finite, the art of the imagination in infinity. And again, let me quote, the poet is either himself nature or he seeks her. In other words, what he's saying is he can't be both. The first of these, the poet who is nature, he calls naive. The second, the poet who seeks nature, he calls sentimentalisch, sentimental. And this use of the word naive and sentimental, which is Schiller's use, is what I propose to employ here. Schiller, like Rousseau, thinks that once ideas enter, peace, harmony, joy are gone forever. The artist becomes conscious of himself. He becomes conscious of his ideal aims. Above all, he becomes conscious of that infinite distance from his own divided nature. That's to say, of the estrangement of his society and of himself from this imagined, or perhaps real, original, unbroken whole of thought and action, feeling and expression. The characteristic poetry of what Schiller called sentimental is satire. It is satire because it's negation. It's an attack on that which calls itself real life, but is in fact a kind of degradation of it, what nowadays is called alienation from it, of what is artificial, ugly, and unnatural. It's either satire or alternatively, it's elegy. Elegy is an affirmation of a lost world, of an unrealizable ideal. This distinction is, and this is quite important, this distinction is not at all the same as the distinction between classical and romantic, whatever that distinction might be, and seems to me a far deeper and far more interesting kind of distinction. And it isn't the same distinction because it isn't concerned with the presence or the absence of things like objective rules or universal standards or fixed criteria or some eternal ideal order, which is what classicism is supposed to be concerned with. Let me give you examples. Aeschylus, Cervantes, Shakespeare, Ossian, all these are heroes of the Romantic movement. All these were in various terms and to various degrees condemned by the classical school as undisciplined and wild. All these are, from Schiller's point of view, naive. Whereas some of the models of classicism, for example, the authors of dramatic or idyllic or satirical or epic poetry, Euripides, for example, Virgil, Horace, Propertius, the neoclassical poets of the Italian Renaissance, all these are nostalgic. They're self-conscious. They're seeking out after some kind of imagined past. Therefore, in his sense of the word, sentimentalish, sentimental. Naive does not correspond to classical any more than sentimental corresponds to romantic. The division cuts quite differently. The naive artist, in Schiller's sense, the naive artist is happily married to his muse. He takes rules and conventions for granted. He doesn't protest against them. He uses them freely and harmoniously. And the effect of his art is, in Schiller's words, tranquil, pure, and joyous. On the other hand, the sentimental artist is always in some kind of turbulent relationship to his muse. If he is married to her, he's married to her unhappily. Conventions irk him, although, of course, he may defend them fanatically. He is like Amfortas in Parsifal. He is a man who seeks peace, salvation, the healing of his own or of his society's secret and open wounds. He can't be at rest. Let me quote Schiller about him again. This is a sentimental artist. His observation is forcibly pushed aside by fancy. His sensibility is pushed aside by ideas. He closes his eyes and ears so that nothing may disturb his self-absorption in his own thoughts. His soul is fascinated by its own play. He never sees the object, only its transformation by his own reflective thought. We can't apprehend his feelings directly at first hand. We can only apprehend their reflection in him, even as he contemplates himself from outside as a kind of spectator. Hence, the effect of the sentimental artist is not joy and not peace, but always tension, conflict with nature, conflict with society, insatiable craving, all the notorious neuroses of the modern age, with its troubled spirits, its martyrs, its fanatics, its rebels, and above all, its angry, bullying, subversive preachers. Rousseau, I suppose, is the first angry young man. Rousseau, Byron, Schopenhauer, Carlyle, Dostoevsky, Flaubert, Wagner, Marx, Nietzsche, all these men who offer not peace, but a sword. Of course, the distinction which Schiller draws between the naive and the sentimental, like all distinctions, if you overdrive it, can be carried too far. If you take it too literally, it can certainly become a kind of pedantry in itself. Nevertheless, it seems to me highly original and very suggestive. If we ask whether in modern times there still exist artists who in Schiller's sense are naive, that is to say, at peace with our medium, happily married to their muse, integral as men and as artists, tranquil, solid, free from self-consciousness, free from obsession, fulfilled artistically in the way in which we think of Cervantes or Bach or Handel or Rubens or Haydn as being fulfilled, if we ask whether there are still men whose art culminates in its object and isn't used for some spiritual end beyond itself, to reach out for some unattainable ideal, or used as a weapon in some war against Philistines and traitors, are there such men? Well, I think we could give some such answer as this. Yes, in modern times, such people have existed. Goethe was like that. Pushkin was like that. Dickens was like that. And even at times, and indeed at most times, Tolstoy, when he forgets his doctrine and when he forgets his guilt. Certainly these are naive in Schiller's sense. And among composers, Rossini and Verdi. Among composers of genius, Verdi is perhaps the last complete self-fulfilled creator, totally absorbed in his art, at one with his art, seeking to use his art for no ulterior purpose. He is the god wholly concealed by his works, severe, farouche, like Schiller's Diana, suspicious of anyone curious about his inner life, wholly, even grimly impersonal, dryly objective, at one with his music. A man who dissolved everything in his art with no more personal residue than Shakespeare or Tintoretto. In Schiller's sense, he is perhaps the last great naive poet of our time. Of course, anybody who has any knowledge of Verdi's life knows that it was in fact intertwined with that of his country, that his name became the very symbol of the Italian Risorgimento, that the great cry Viva Verdi was the most famous revolution and patriotic cry in Italy. This, of course, is a kind of pun, is a kind of subterfuge. V-E-R-D-I stood for Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia, which was forbidden under the Austrians, and when people said Viva Verdi, they did so for revolutionary or monarchist reasons at times. Nevertheless, the fact that Verdi's name was chosen was not accidental. Verdi was a very complete kind of Italian. He admired all the Italian statesmen who were pitted against each other, admired them equally. He admired both Mazzini and Cavour. He admired both the revolutionary democrats and the king. And in this way, he united in his person all the diverse strands which made the Italian nation in the 19th century. The German philosopher Herder in the 18th century used to talk about certain artists and writers who stand near the center of the gravity of their nation, as opposed to those who stand at its periphery. In this sense, I think Verdi did stand certainly near the heart, near the center of Italian gravity. He spoke not only to his countrymen, but for them. And he spoke as no one else did, not even the great novelist Manzoni, not even Garibaldi, to both of whom he was personally close. Verdi's convictions, whether they moved to the right or to the left, moved with the waves of popular feeling. He responded deeply and personally to every twist and every turn in the great Italian struggle for unity and freedom. The Hebrews of his opera Nabucco were, of course, Italians in Austrian captivity. The great hymn from that opera, Va Pensiero, was a national prayer for resurrection. The performance of Battaglia di Legnano evoked scenes of incredible popular excitement in the revolutionary Rome in 1849. Rigoletto, as much as Don Carlo, as much as Forza del Destino, as much as Aida, is inspired by a hatred of oppression, inequality, fanaticism, and every form of human degradation. The great hymn, great only in the sense that Verdi felt inspired when he wrote it. Musically, it is a very inferior piece. The hymn which Verdi wrote for Mazzini is only an episode in a single great campaign. For half a century, Verdi remained the living symbol of all that was most generous and universal in Italian national feeling. All this is no doubt so. Nevertheless, it isn't really at the center of Verdi's art. I mean, all this national, all this political feeling. Insight into his music doesn't require us to know either all or any of all this. Of course, any knowledge of what a man of genius was like and what a man of genius felt is interesting, but it isn't always essential. My point is this, that whereas it is essential in the case of the masters whom, in Schiller's sense, one would like to call sentimental, it isn't so in the case of those whom Schiller called naive. Take, for example, the case of Beethoven. Beethoven, in Schiller's sense, is certainly a sentimental master. No one who doesn't realize what Beethoven felt about tyranny can fully understand the Eroica or even Fidelio, which is, I suppose, as somebody I think once said, the first great political opera. Nobody who doesn't know anything about the kind of social movements which were going on in Russia in the mid-19th century can understand the full significance of Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov or his Khovanshchina. Schumann's aesthetic outlook, Wagner's mythology, the kind of romantic theories that dominated Berlioz, all these are certainly indispensable anyhow to a full understanding of their masterpieces, but it really isn't necessary in this sense to know what were Shakespeare's political views. It isn't necessary simply to the understanding of his historical plays. It might help, but it isn't required. This is also the case with Verdi. Anybody who is acquainted with primary human passions, paternal love, the full horror of the humiliation of men by other men in a dehumanized society, will understand Rigoletto. You don't really need anything else in order to understand that, except musical sense. Insight into a hero destroyed by jealousy is enough to understand Othello. Knowledge of basic human feelings is virtually all the non-musical equipment that you need if you are to understand Verdi's work, early or late, great or small. Just as much to understand Suoni la Tromba as La Traviata, Attila or Luisa Miller, Forza del Destino or Aida, Il Corsaro or Hernani, just as much and just as little as Trovatore or The Requiem or Otello or even Falstaff. Take, for example, Falstaff. Falstaff is musically and artistically absolutely unique. Nevertheless, the requirements needed to do it justice don't include anyhow as indispensable knowledge of the personal views or the personal attributes of the composer, nor of the historical circumstances of his life, nor those of his society. This is really not needed in his case, any more than it's needed in the case of Bach, or the case of Mozart, or the case of Rossini, or for that matter, Shakespeare, or Goethe, or Dickens. From the early opera, from Alberto Conte di Bonifacio, to the four sacred pieces which is the last work the master wrote, the character of his creations is, in Schiller's special sense, altogether naive. They spring from a direct vision of the object. There's no effort in them to reach to something beyond, to some infinite and some unattainable empyrean. There's no effort to lose oneself in an element of this kind. There's no ulterior aim. There's no impossible attempt to fuse antagonistic worlds, music and literature, the personal and the public, concrete reality and transcendent myth. Verdi never, consciously at any rate, seeks to close a breach, to compensate for the imperfections of human life, or to heal his own wounds, or overcome his society's inner cracks, what nowadays is called alienation from a common culture, or alienation from some ancient faith by using magical means, by conjuring up some infernal or some celestial vision which other poets have conjured up as a means of escape, or as a means of revenge, or as a means of personal or national salvation. And this seems to me to be just as true of Falstaff as it is of a comparatively trivial work like Un Giorno di Regno, which is his only other comedy. It's just as true of his string quartet as it is of his any other works. There's a British philosopher in the 18th century, namely Bishop Butler, who said, I think I'm quoting him correctly, I hope I am, who said, desire culminates in its object. Verdi belongs to this tradition, and he represents its finest flowering. Verdi's art, like the art of Bach, is objective, it is direct, and it is in harmony with the conventions which govern it. It springs from an unbroken inner unity. It springs from a sense of belonging to its own time, its own society, its own milieu. And this is the kind of thing which totally precludes the kind of nostalgia for the infinite, the conception of art as some kind of therapy, as some kind of healing, which lies at the heart of what Schiller calls sentimental. In this sense, classical poets like Virgil, Propertius, and Horace were sentimental. Sentimental and also models of classicism. While, on the other hand, the Song of the Nibelungs or Don Quixote, which was idealized by the Romantics, are naive. My thesis is that Verdi was the last of the great naive masters of Western music. And he was that during an age, on the whole, which was given over to what Schiller calls sentimental. He remained scarcely affected by it. He may have been interested in, he may even have been influenced by, Wagner or Liszt or Meyerbeer. But the influence is confined to method, technical innovations. That's all he was interested in their music, simply their skill as composers, inventors of means to certain musical ends. The worlds of these composers, of Wagner or Liszt or Meyerbeer, the worlds of these men and their doctrines remained alien to Verdi. After Verdi, naivete is to be found anyhow in the West. Only in what we might call the borderlands, outside the central movement, among the composers of countries on the edge, Slav countries, Spain, possibly Norway, where social conditions towards the end of the 19th century resembled the earlier kind of Europe. I don't mean to say that Verdi has no ideology. This wouldn't be true, I think, of any artist. But his ideology, if you like to call it that, is fundamentally that of vast numbers of mankind across large stretches of history. This is indeed one of the central meanings which anyhow I attach to the term humanism. The Italian novelist Moravia, Alberto Moravia, traces this universality in Verdi, this profound connection with large masses of mankind, to Verdi's peasant origin and to his peasant upbringing, which in his view triumphed over the bourgeois society of his time. Peasants are an ancient and universal social class, and if it is this that worked in Verdi, it's not irrelevant to what Rousseau and Schiller meant by relatively uncorrupted relationship with nature. Of course, the attacks on Verdi are notorious. They came from a great many quarters. That is what I mean by saying he lived in an age which artistically, in a certain sense, was not altogether sympathetic to him. And he reflects something earlier. These attacks came from all kinds of sources. In England, for example, Mr. Chorley, who used to write, I think, for the Times, found him too noisy. That means too vulgar, compared to Rossini or Boieldieu or whoever it is that Mr. Chorley preferred. Nor was the wish to return to Rossini and to Bellini confined to the conservatives of the North. It came from the Italians themselves. Least of all, let it be noted, from Rossini himself, who admired Verdi very much. Naturally, the principal onslaught came from the champions of the new music, the Wagnerians and the Liszians. They were protagonists of all that was most self-conscious, most extra-musical, most, in Schiller's sense of the word, sentimental. It came from people whose faith in music had something to do with a belief in the messianic rebirth of the human spirit. Arrigo Boito, who supplied the libretti of both Otello and Falstaff, and who was later to denounce Wagner as a false prophet, was in his own day deeply caught by it. He repented. His explosion against Verdi as being too unlike the new music is very well known, but it didn't last very long. In the end, of course, he became one of Verdi's most fervent admirers. No doubt this is as it should be. Verdi was the greatest, most triumphant obstacle to the great new aesthetic religion. If you belonged to the votaries of Wagner or of Liszt, it clearly wasn't worth wasting powder and shot on composers of the calibre of Pacini or Mercadante, not even on Meyerbeer or Auber or Alevi, so long as Verdi was dominant. Verdi was the archenemy. Verdi was the great traditionalist, the great reactionary of power and genius. Still more violent than the attacks of the Wagnerians were the attacks from further east, delivered by the great new national school of the Slav world, particularly the Russians. Composers like Balakirev and Baradin, Mussorgsky and Stasov, well, Stasov was not a composer, but a critic, but he was very close to these people absolutely detested Verdi. They didn't detest him merely for his occasional platitudes and vulgarities, not for Questa e Quella or for arias like O tu Palermo, but for the very qualities in which his strength truly resided. They hated him for his acceptance of, for his identification with what they call the hated formula, the awful conventions of Italian opera. The Russians were inspired by populist ideals. They were disciples of the unknown master Dargamushsky, whom they regarded as a genius of the first order. And they followed him in believing in musical realism, in the most intimate interrelation of words, plot, expression, music, historical and social consciousness. The Russians virtually invented that expressive semi-recitative to convey the finest psychological nuances of what they conceived of as the real inner and outer life, both of individuals and of the masses. When the Italian composer and pianist Busoni later said that love scenes shouldn't occur on the stage, because what is intimate should never take place in public, this highly sophisticated man echoed, however unconsciously, this kind of literal realism. No doubt Busoni would have been horrified to be told that he was doing this. Nevertheless, it is what he was doing. The Russians I mentioned, the members of the nationalist school, were in open revolt against the entire Italian tradition of opera, the tradition of Paisiello and Cherubini, of Rossini and Donizetti and Bellini. At long last, they felt, certainly in the 50s, the miserable crew of operatic purveyors showed signs of going under. But then an awful thing happened. Verdi breathed new life into this ghastly tradition and reconquered the musical public for the beastly formula, the mechanical succession of detachable operatic numbers, the little bits and pieces which could be performed in any order, for example, from the Requiem with which Verdi and his singers toured Europe. The Russians denounced all these self-contained arias, duets, trios, quintets, choruses, the inevitable appoggiaturas, the artificially stuck-on cavalettas and cavatinas, the entire mechanism of this awful, predictable orchestral accompaniment, the frightful hurdy-gurdy, which in their view killed the living expression of real experience. To these men, an opera like Prince Igor seemed to them spontaneous and real, whereas Don Carlos and Traviata were simply Christmas trees, decked out with little meretricious baubles. Not that these men liked Wagner any better. Baradin delivered a fearful attack on him. He seemed to them no better than what Boito called him, or Boito called him after he became converted, back to Verdi. He called him a pompous disseminator of clamorous confusion, which roughly corresponds to the Russian point of view at the time. The Russian composer Serov, who admired and imitated Wagner, was therefore drummed out of the nationalist regiment. The gods of these Russians were Liszt and Berlioz. The greatest enemy was always Verdi, on whom they looked exactly the way in which the early German romantics looked on the French arbiters of taste in the 18th century. The French seemed to the German romantics simply a collection of shallow, pompous, stilted, artificial, utterly predictable, utterly worthless writers. Liszt and Berlioz were, in this sense, Rousseau. The return to the colors and the sounds of nature, to real individual feeling, return to these true values from the corrupt, commercialized sophistication of the standardized authors. French authors like Marivaux, like Crébillon, like Marmontel, above all Voltaire, who seemed to them like little dancing masters with their powdered wigs and their rhymed couplets and their carefully contrived epigrams moving about amid the bric-a-brac of the trivial and heartless salons. This was fundamentally the attack of the sentimental on the naive. That is what the Germans had done as far as the French were concerned, in the 18th century, or towards the end of it. And in the 19th century, this happened in the case of the Russians and Verdi again. No doubt equally inevitable, and no doubt equally exaggerated and wrong-headed. Verdi went his own way, wounded, but ultimately serene and unperturbed. No doubt he didn't belong to the New World. He didn't belong to the world of Baudelaire, or Liszt, or Wagner, or Flaubert, or Nietzsche, or Dostoevsky, or Mussorgsky. There's absolutely no reason to think that he was in the least aware of this, or would have cared if he had been. Verdi's was the last great voice of a humanism which was not at war with itself, at any rate, in music. No matter how sophisticated Verdi's scores may be, there is never any trace, it seems to me, until the very end, of any neurosis, any self-consciousness, any decadence. If you want to look for that in Italian music, you must wait for Boito, for Puccini, and for their followers. Verdi was the last master who painted with positive, clear, primary colors. He gave direct expression to the eternal major human emotions: love and hate, jealousy and fear, indignation and passion, grief, fury, mockery, cruelty, irony, fanaticism, faith, all these passions that all men know. After him, this happens much more seldom. From Debussy onwards, whether the music is impressionist or expressionist, neoclassical or neoromantic, diatonic or chromatic, dodecaphonic, aleatoric or concrete, or a mixture of all these, whichever it is, this kind of innocence, which belongs to the naive artist, is gone. There is a sense, which I wish to make clear, in which this is not at all the sense of naive in which certain composers can be called naive in the ordinary sense of the word. There is a sense, for example, in which Bruckner can be called naive, but that's the ordinary sense, not Schiller's sense. In Schiller's sense of the word, Bruckner's visionary mysticism, his combination of sensuousness and his vast effort at self-transcendence, and this was exactly the same, for example, in the even acuter case of Cesar Franck or of the Schola Cantorum, which he founded. This is the deepest imaginable sentimentality. And so, of course, is the very notion of the Wagnerian Gesamtkunstwerk, this enormous striving for some unattainable integration of all the uncombinable elements. Everyone knows that towards the end of the 19th century, as a kind of reaction against the vast inflation, what one can only call the appalling elephantiasis of late German Romanticism, there came into being a variety of highly astringent deflationary styles. But the conscious return to Bach, or to Pergolesi, or to Gesualdo, or earlier still to Machaut, this kind of neoclassicism, is of course a conscious effort to look for antidotes. There's no doubt that this has generated much extremely original and fascinating music, anti-sentimental in Schiller's sense, and thereby itself sentimental, inasmuch as anything which is self-regarding, which is self-conscious, which is doctrine-influenced, whatever the doctrine may be, anything which is accompanied by theories and by manifestos, things like, for example, neo-Catholic music, which follows the doctrine of solemn, or eternal music, or surrealist music, or socialist-realist music, or neo-diatonic music, and so on, anything of this kind which needs manifestos to justify it is, by that very fact alone, to be defined as, in Schiller's sense, sentimental. We do expect ideological declarations, statements of programs, tremendous anathemas from composers like Wagner or Berlioz or Debussy or the Russian composers in the 20th century. But we should have been extremely surprised if someone told us that there was a manifesto on the function of literature, say, signed by Dickens or signed by the elder Dumas. We shouldn't really regard that as very possible. In the same sort of way, a profession of official faith by Verdi, let us say on the aesthetic or the social significance of Italian opera, or the relationship of Italian opera to, let us say, the Commedia dell'arte, the kind of declaration that is to be found in the writings of, let us say, Boito or Busoni. If anyone told us that Verdi had produced something of this kind, I think on the whole we should suspect that what we were dealing with was an exceptionally unclausable forgery. Manifestos are a symptom of revolt, or a symptom of reaction, personal or collective. That is to say, they are a symptom of an acute phase of self-consciousness, sentimentality. The fact that Verdi, who is so often and, in a sense, perfectly justly described as one of the most deeply characteristic and representative artists of the 19th century, was remote from this particular condition, a condition which is usually held to be a central feature of that period, its typical malaise. And perhaps this is one of the things which is most arresting in his personality, both as an artist and as a man. In this respect, Verdi has no successors. In music, at least, he is the last naive artist of genius. The desire to go back to Verdi is itself a form of incurable nostalgia, is itself a form of extremely non-Verdian sentimentality from which Verdi himself was wholly and peacefully free. It's, of course, perfectly natural that the kind of thing which, during the high tide of what might be called the sentimental movement, let us say from the 1870s to the 1930s, the kind of thing that was looked on both by the Germans and the anti-Germans, that's to say the Franco-Russian musical public, and by the critics who belonged to this kind of public, the kind of thing which was looked at as Verdi's popular, vulgar style, the fact that this should have re-emerged during the last quarter of a century is an exceedingly interesting fact, for it is really the last direct voice of the great tradition. And it's felt to be that, in perfectly conscious contrast with its opposite being the quest for the remote and for the exotic, which is always a symptom of recession, always a symptom of a desire to get comfort or to derive some kind of new life from traditions remote in space and time. The music of the Middle Ages, or the music of the Age of Reason, or the relics of a folk tradition in Eastern Europe, or in Asia, or Africa, or the islands of the Pacific. Verdi's voice is the voice of a world which is no more. His voice is noble, simple, and with a degree of unbroken vitality and vast natural power of creation and organization. Verdi's vast popularity among the most sophisticated, as well as the most ordinary listeners today, is due to the fact that he expressed permanent states of consciousness in the most direct terms, in the way in which Homer or Shakespeare or Ibsen or Tolstoy have expressed this. This is exactly what Schiller called naive. After Verdi, it seems to me, at any rate, that this is not heard in music again. Verdi's by now completely assured place in the high canon of musical art which scarcely anybody would today dispute, seems to be one of the few symptoms of sanity in our time. The sociology of this phenomenon, how, so to speak, what the relation of Verdi is to his own time, and the general question of what brings about naive and sentimental art, and the relation of this art to the social and to the spiritual condition of a given period. This, like Verdi's own position in his own time, is a very fascinating topic, but not one about which I propose to say anything, if only because I'm wholly unqualified to deal with it. But it is a fascinating topic, and I greatly hope that someone may be persuaded to address himself to it.